Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to the 223rd edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you an American perspective of our clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You can get your daily reading from me and other writers over at SoccerNewsDay.com, as well as locally on FansFavorite.com. Chat room is open. Come on in. Discuss whatever you like amongst yourselves. If you have a question for me, I'll try to answer it to the best of my ability as possible. And as we saw another fun and successful moment at the NSCAA convention located in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, another MLS Super Draft has come and gone. And I got to say to those moving on up from the college ranks to the professional ranks, congratulations. Good luck to you boys, and hopefully you'll have fruitful careers in professional soccer. If not in MLS, at least you will get opportunities elsewhere, either in the NASL or in the USL Pro League, and we'll see what happens there. But speaking about that conference, I have to say that I want to commend Commissioner Don Garber for talking to the media in between the rounds, or at least when he was finished doing the first round of the Super Draft, to discuss the situation that was the Frank Lampard conundrum. And, you know, he finally came out because, let's be honest, the first time he did discuss the situation, that was more of a passing along type of situation. Not the Grant Wall interview, but it was the Grant Wall interview. You know, nothing against Grant or anything like that. He always does a fantastic job. But the way that Don Garber answered those questions was just absolutely the wrong way to make a mess even a lot worse. But finally, he had a good discussion with the American soccer media, and I just want to say I commend him for doing a very good job finally coming around and explaining the situation properly. No doubt in my mind that hopefully we'll never see another fiasco like this again involving Manchester City and their affiliate at Yankee Stadium. So hopefully this situation is officially over and done with, and hopefully we'll never get another one like we had a couple of weeks ago when it was first announced before the new year rang. Other than that, you know, we just have to say that the one thing that needs to start right away, or if it did start right away and it hasn't been shown, is this. The favorite word coming out of Don Garber at any interview he does, whether it's a State of the League address, which it's not really a State of the League address unless you have a bunch of media members covering it, but the word transparency keeps being discussed, and no matter how many times it's been discussed by the commissioner of Major League Soccer, it just doesn't seem like it's been coming. Because I have to say that no matter how many times he says it, it's not being executed. And that's the one problem I'm having with these situations, is that when will we have real transparency? I understand that, you know, Don Garber has to remain close to the vest when talking about league situations. But he's the one that keeps talking about we need transparency. We need to start to be transparent, talking about how Major League Soccer is being run. And the truth of the matter is that no matter how many times you're going to say it, you're going to have to do it. And since you haven't been doing it, then what's the point of saying it? Because right now we have issues that needs to be discussed. Every single year, when you are describing or trying to talk about certain things or certain players coming into the league, whether it's a national team player coming back to Major League Soccer, oh, there must be an allocation, a weighted lottery allocation to see what's going on, or you know, whatever allocation money you're going to get from the league to get said player, or something, whatever happens. You know, once again, you know, you always say, you know, or that one time it was, well, we make up the rules, or we'll make it up as we go along. So basically you're flying off the seat of your pants, and I wonder how many times that the rule book is going to be written in pencil, then erased, then rewritten in pencil, then erased again, and then rewrite it in pencil until all of a sudden, okay, it's fine, and we'll get the ink to make it permanent. So that's my issue here. Transparency. Because to be honest with you, I am just not seeing it. Look, we understand what's going on here. We all understand what the situation is. Obviously, you want to make sure that nothing is going to go wrong or nothing's going to get leaked. And I understand that. Look, I'm a simple man. I understand what you're trying to do. I understand what the situation is. And as long as we all agree that, you know, this is for the league to remain operating, this is going to be the 20th season of Major League Soccer. I'm very proud of that. I'm very happy about it. I'm hoping that we'll get past the 25-year mark or the 25th season mark so that we can celebrate that season, the 25 years of MLS as well. I just would like a little more common sense, actually a lot more common sense, to be honest, because to be honest with you, Commissioner Garber, there's a lot of shenanigans going on. And while I understand that you want to keep everything quiet as possible, you know, even the smallest of things that you're trying to keep quiet about, I mean, that's just ridiculous. What I want is what you're talking about, because don't you want people to listen to what you have to say? I mean, I know you've got people agreeing with you, and I can agree with you too. I want to agree with you, to be honest with you. And to be honest, I have agreed on some of the things you've done. I have disagreed on some of the things you've done. But if I can see on some of the things that I've disagreed with you upon are actually good for the league, then I can change my mind and say, hey, listen, I was wrong. That was a great idea that the commissioner had a long time ago, and now it's becoming it's beginning to flourish. I want to agree with you. I do. Because every single time I have come on my show, and every single time I've discussed these things, and every single time I keep telling my audience, is this. You have done a fantastic job running the league. You really have. You really, really have. And the truth is this, is that everything you have tried to do, it's worked. There have been some things that have not worked. And there are some things that I understand you work for the owners. But when it comes to the situation of Chivas USA, even though they are no longer in MLS, the truth of the matter is this, is that I wish you would have gone to the gentleman that owned the club that also owns Guadalajara down in Mexico, in Mr. Jorge Vergara, and you should have just said to him, listen, you got to be in it or you're not, because I need to know what the heck is going on here. And when you haven't been a little bit more forceful, and I understand the owners are your bosses, I understand that, but still, when it comes to the situation about who's going to stay and who's going to go, you need to talk to them. You need to go to them and say, listen, I need to know what's going on here. Pardon me. Need to know if you really are committed, because it's one thing to go up in front of a podium and a microphone and say it, and there's another thing when you're not in front of the microphone or not in front of the podium and you're just not going to do it. And the whole thing about the David Beckham Miami to MLS situation is this, in my opinion. I think your timetable or your time limit is wrong. There should have never been a time limit at all about bringing Miami or bringing MLS back to Miami at all, because that was the wrong thing to do. And you're putting Beckham under the gun. And here's the other thing. When CONCACAF had their World Cup qualifying draw for rounds 1 and 2 this last Thursday, who was there to pick the balls in the single middle pot to see who was going to be hosting the first leg and who was going to be hosting the second leg in the first two rounds of qualifying for Russia 2018? It wasn't David Beckham. It was Ronaldo from Brazil. So let me ask this question then. Is David Beckham no longer an influential person in South Florida, in the Miami area? Honestly, who knows? But what I saw gave me reason to believe that the Fort Lauderdale Strikers of the NASL has now one-upped Beckham and his group. And the thing is this. I don't know if this is ever going to happen. Now, to the Southern Legion, I'm not saying this because I'm trying to get your goat. I'm not. I want MLS to be in Miami. I want a club to be in Miami and to do it the right way. The right way was really, really simple. You should have rented out the Dolphins NFL Stadium, or if you wanted to, maybe play where the Marlins are, at a la Yankee Stadium, that whole sort of thing. But honestly, you should have started off in either the Dolphins NFL Stadium or renting out the Marlins baseball stadium until you get a real plan going. Because it's better to be safe than sorry. And then what happens when you get to the drop-dead date or the drop-dead year and you're disappointed again? And I don't want you guys to be disappointed at all. I want you guys to get the stadium. But, you know, once again, I'm not familiar with the area so much. I only know the area, or at least a couple of roads here and there, because my parents are living now in South Florida. And once again, Don Garber keeps saying, we're not going to give Miami the franchise all the way unless you get a downtown stadium in Miami. Where downtown are you going to put it? Because I'm telling you right now, unless someone else knows where they're going to put a downtown soccer stadium, I don't see it. Really, really don't see it. This is why we got to make sure that, not that if not, Miami's not the right city. I think Miami is the right city. The question is, where in Miami are you going to put it? And if you don't know where in Miami you're going to put it, then you got a problem. We cannot have this problem ever again. That's all I'm saying. Now, like I've said, the only thing I can say or help out with the situation is this. Amtrak in Miami, downtown Miami, they're planning to do some form of a Grand Central Station terminal in downtown Miami. And if you did that, maybe you knock off the current Miami station, Amtrak station, because you have at least internal city transit that goes to that area. So at least you can put it there when the whole thing is finished with this downtown Miami Grand Central Station, and let's hope that happens. Great show for you tonight. My good buddy Rob Hawk was at the Red Bulls town hall meeting. We'll give you some information there. James O'Connor, head coach of the brand new Louisville City FC USL Pro Club that will start this season. On a taped interview, once again, Mr. Nathan Carr will rejoin me to discuss CONCACAF World Cup qualifying as well as the under-20 CONCACAF tournament. And joining me very shortly, a man that I have been trying to get on the show for a good while. Now, obviously, we kind of talk every once in a while about our neighbors north of the border up in Canada. We got to go and talk to them about what goes on in up north of the border. And this gentleman, I heard him for the first time when I used to work at a sports news service. Doing a CONCACAF Gold Cup tournament was at the time, I think this was back in 2002. This gentleman was doing the analyzing for Rogers Sportsnet, and he, along with Jerry Dobson, gotta say it was well done, and you know, because at the time Fox Sports wasn't doing it. Fox Soccer Channel wasn't doing it. ESPN wasn't doing it. We had to get Univision here in the States. But because of where I worked, because we could get the Canadian sports channels once in a while. And this man who was doing the analyzing, of course, was a member of that 2000 Gold Cup Canadian winning side. And this man is absolutely brilliant, how he calls the games, or not so much calls, but analyzes the games over up in Canada for Sportsnet now. They're called Mr. Craig Forrest, who was part of that 2000 Canadian Gold Cup winning side. You know, no one ever thought that Canada was going to do it. No one ever thought Canada was going to do anything, because obviously the quarterfinal match was against Mexico. And when they did it, it was just a miracle. It was just, at the time, of course, you had guest teams in the Gold Cup. And at the time, it was really strange to see that, but really, that's what it was back at the time in 2000. Joining me right now, that gentleman from that Gold Cup winning side in Canada, Mr. Craig Forrest. Craig, thank you for the time and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.
Now, before we talk about that Gold Cup winning side, Canada drawn in the second round of World Cup qualifying for the road to Russia, and they'll be awaiting the winners of British Virgin Islands or Dominica in early June. Now, obviously, this sounds like Canada, either opponent will be an easy task, but you've seen your share of crazy things that happens in World Cup qualifying in this confederation.
Yeah, that's for sure, right? I mean, anything can happen, but, you know, if we can't get past that stage of the World Cup qualifying, then we're in big trouble. I mean, the federation's in, or, you know, Canada's in a bit of trouble as it is, and so to lose out in that stage would be a devastating blow to our association.
Yeah, it really would, and hopefully that won't happen, and we can see Canada get drawn in the third round when the big draw happens July 25th. Now, that Gold Cup team you were a part of, and boy, I didn't, you know, I watched it here in the States through Univision, obviously, Spanish language television. I never knew that Pat Onstad or Dwayne De Rosario was on your Gold Cup winning side. Were they just hanging around, I guess, you know, wet behind the ears back in those days, or they were pretty good players back then as well?
Oh, they were. I mean, Dwayne De Rosario was just coming onto the scene really at that stage. What caught Frank Yallop's eye was what he did with the national team, because he brought him to Major League Soccer, which was massively successful with San Jose. And then from there, he just grew and obviously became an important member of the Canadian national team later on. But Pat Onstad was pretty much the same age as me at the time. And we had gone way back to youth development in Coquitlam, British Columbia, just outside of Vancouver. And we're part of the under-20 World Cup team in 1987 in Chile. And then during World Cup qualifying and all the tournaments and whatnot, right into the Gold Cup. So we were teammates for an awful long time, right from being quite young in BC.
Yeah, that's Yep, that's very awesome to hear about that. And, of course, with this Gold Cup tournament, I think it was really strange to see how your group, and of course back then it was four groups of three sides, you had in your group a guest team in South Korea. Of course, Costa Rica was there. Costa Rica with their, I guess the goals for, got them into the quarterfinals. But that coin flip, that must have been strange because it's been all draws in your group and Canada had to advance on a coin flip. Did you ever experience anything like that before? Like, as I know you were playing for Ipswich Town in England, did you, like during an FA Cup, did you have to at least like a coin toss of some sort to get it across to the next stage of anything?
No, it never happened before. We knew there was a possibility, and with only playing in groups of three and having, you know, two games, I guess the probability of being tied in goals for and against and same results against two teams is more probable. And in the end, it was down to us and South Korea, who had beaten, had just had an identical record with goals for, two goals against, 2 points, wins, it was or two draws, because everybody drew in those games. And then we won that. And it was interesting because Holger Osiak, our coach, I mean, we're talking about crazy stuff that happens in CONCACAF, but CONCACAF wanted to do the coin toss behind closed doors. And Holger obviously wasn't going to have any to do with that. And he was going to be standing and hovering right over top of them when they did it. And then on the other hand, I had a, I can't remember the golf course, but I had a really good round of golf set up the next day if I'd actually lost the coin toss. So it was quite interesting. I was like, hey, we won, but I wonder, that golf course probably would have been pretty nice too. Because obviously at that stage, then we had Mexico in the quarterfinals, and that's what the coin toss won us. And obviously the powerhouse that is Mexico, stronger, especially back in those days on home soil, of course, but down in San Diego, there was a great deal of support for them, of course, being the quality that they are and the problems we've had with them in the past, and especially away from Canada, not a lot of people held out hope. And we certainly had hope, but obviously it was going to be a difficult task, and things just aligned brilliantly in that game, really, with Carlo Corzine scoring late to tie it up. And I just felt that at that point Mexico had got into a gear that they couldn't get out of, and they thought they were just going to see the game out, which looked pretty probable. And then going into the golden goal at that stage was again caught them a little bit off. They got a corner really early, we broke away, and then Richard Hastings ended up scoring, so there was no reply from them, and we hit them sort of with a sucker punch and found ourselves stumbled right into the semifinal.
Just out of curiosity, if I can ask this question, because the United States played a day before Canada took on Mexico, and it was against the other guest team in Colombia. The United States losing in the penalty round shootout against Colombia, did that also give an oomph to the side? Because, like we said before, we've seen strange things happen. It doesn't matter what tournament it's involved in, club tournament, national team tournament. Did that give you and the rest of your teammates for Canada like a little more oomph to face against Mexico, even though you were down in the 36th minute?
You know, not really, because we really weren't concerned at all about any of the other groups. The only thing in the game that we had in front of us was the team that's favored or equal favored to win the competition. So getting through them, it was really a case of, and literally a case of, okay, who do we have next? Because it was unexpected. You know, in these type of tournament formats, you always got your bags packed because your association is going to get you out of there as quickly as possible after you lose out of the tournament like that. So we didn't think about anything else. As it happened, it worked out well that Colombia had done that, although you know, Colombia were no pushovers, let's face that, at that particular time. But we were quite happy to have Trinidad and Tobago in the semis.
What's it like to face a side like Trinidad and Tobago? Because obviously, Dwight York, that played for Manchester United back in those days, I mean, you've probably played against Manchester United in your career with Ipswich. Did you feel like you had an advantage when you took on Trinidad and Tobago because you knew how Dwight York likes to shoot the ball or be in certain places on the pitch to get the ball and score?
Yeah, somewhat. But I remember at the time Dwight York had picked up an injury, and I don't believe he played any part in that game. He was at the stadium, but I don't believe he played any part. I may be wrong in that, and because I have played against him several times in England when he was at Villa and Manchester United, but that was a big thing. And we actually didn't play very well. That was probably our worst game, and I think partially because at that time we knew Colombia was in the final, which meant as an invitational team. And it didn't. Well, actually, we didn't know. I think they're playing Peru. So either or, they're both invitational teams. So we knew if we had beaten Trinidad and Tobago, we would have got at least a berth in the Confederations Cup, because we still would have won our Confederations even if we didn't win the final. So we were very nervous, and the team played like that. We didn't create many chances at all, and they had a penalty just before halftime, which I was fortunate enough to save. And it didn't look very good. And at that point, I wasn't very confident. I thought we could maybe nick a goal on a set piece, which we ended up doing. And then in the final against Colombia, I think because of the fact that they were an invitational team and we had already technically won the Confederation, at least got ourselves a berth in the Confed Cup, it really took a lot of pressure off our team against such a quality nation like that. And we played, I thought, a terrific game. Best tournament game I think that Canada's ever played was against Colombia in the final, which was pretty impressive and obviously very important to Canadian history.
Absolutely. And of course, even though you technically the victory for the Gold Cup was on that semifinal match, but still, I think many Canadians would probably say, well, thank goodness you did win the final, because you lose the final, but you get the trophy anyway. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, you wouldn't get the trophy. You just get the berth of the Confederations Cup, because obviously Colombia wouldn't be representing CONCACAF at that stage. But no, you wouldn't have got the trophy, and it would have been terribly disappointing. But just that little bit of pressure taken off the squad of players who were mostly playing, 50% were playing in Europe at the and then a lot were playing for the Canadian in the Canadian Soccer League at that time, which was an important league for Canada. I thought through the NASL through the 70s and 80s, but then there was a gap, and then the CSL really did a good job at least giving players in Canada somewhere to play on a regular basis and somewhat of a professional environment, which really helped our national team. Even though they weren't the most finished of players, they were certainly tough and tactically very aware, execution not the very best, but very well organized. And we did. We never expected to do something like win the Gold Cup, but we always thought we would give a pretty good account of ourselves.
Now, obviously, since then, it's been a rough road for Canada, national team-wise, obviously. Myself, personally, I feel the North Zone should always be very, very strong. Of course, we always know about Mexico. We now know with the United States. And I've always felt Canada should always be with the U.S. and Mexico, because this is the North Zone. This is supposed to be the strongest zone in the Confederation. Since the Gold Cup championship back in 2000, why has Canada struggled?
Well, I don't think there's one thing that you can put a finger on. Certainly, development and youth development has been slow. There's not... unlike the United States, where they've got very serious about the game and right down to the grassroots level, they'll pay, qualified coaches to be technical directors of their youth clubs, and really structured in a very, very good way, and which has seen some amazing things done in the United States in the last 20, 30 years, really. It's been a great, just how the game has evolved. It's just been terrific to watch. And we're certainly behind that, because back in the... even 86 when Canada qualified for the World Cup, the United States weren't the factor that they were now. Prior to 1986, the United States weren't really Canada's biggest opponent. It was Central American teams. Well, obviously that's changed. But development has been slow. We have we have three professional teams with Major League Soccer, which have really only been around for the last 8 or 9 years max, and that was Toronto. They'll do a good job as far as developing some Canadian players, and we've seen the benefit of that already. But it's still small. When you look at, say, the English system, when there's 92 professional clubs, they're all developing players. They're doing the job for the national system, and it just cream rises to the top, and then you pick your players. Well, with only three teams that are pretty young in the in Major League Soccer, it's going to take a while before we see the big benefits of that. And, you know, so the competitive nature of things, a lot of the kids are playing through the university system, which I think is a fantastic route. But it's not the caliber that we'll see players really strive and be massively successful in Major League Soccer. And they've seen that happen. There has been some success with university players, but they're finding the youth development and playing against top quality opposition has developed players better. So it's been slow. And right now we're going through a really tough patch because most of the players don't play at top class teams and at the top end of the game. So it's hard to expect that we're going to do well against top-class players that do play in the better leagues in the world. Plus the squad of players that played against Iceland recently. I believe there is 6 or 7 players that are actually on that squad that are unattached. So unattached, these players can't even find clubs anywhere. So pretty hard to expect to do anything anywhere in the world, whether it's CONCACAF or Europe.
And finally, before I let you go, you and Jerry Dobson has been the backbone for Canadian soccer broadcasts, whether it's locally with Toronto or the national team. I guess my question is this. Do you ever rib him? Because he's the one that called the tournament for Canada back in 2000. Do you ever
That's
let him
right.
have it a little bit? Like, hey Jerry, you ever let Jerry have it once in a while? I just had a curiosity because
I think
he's been doing
a
lot
sometimes.
Longer than anyone else.
yeah, he's been great. I mean, yeah, I do. And the interesting thing back then was that we, for the most part, go to and televise games live from location in the Gold Cup. We've been all over the place in Seattle and Chicago, Los Angeles. Now there's a group in Toronto this coming summer, which is actually great. But in 2000, it was a case of the company basically thinking, and the association, because there was a partnership between them, the television network Sportsnet, and they decided, I don't think we're going to go very far. It's not really worth setting up a big production team and a truck down at Coliseum in San Diego and where else. So they decided to do it on just off the tube, sitting in a studio back in Toronto. And obviously that was a massive regret for the company, but they've also gone to tournaments where they thought they were going to do well, and then they get dumped out really quickly. So they sometimes try to angle it that they don't lose too much money. So Jerry was actually sitting in Toronto calling that game off the tube, which he doesn't like doing. None of us do. But under those circumstances, it was a big moment for him, and he was actually not even out of the game.
Now, that's really tough. But listen, Craig, thank you so much for the time. I really do appreciate it. Good luck with Canada and World Cup qualifying, and of course, good luck with the Gold Cup coming up. And I hope to hear from you again soon. You're more than welcome to come back on the show anytime you want.
Oh, great. Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate you having me on.
I appreciate you joining me and having the invitation. Take care.
Cheers. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Craig Forrest up in Canada, Sportsnet. As he is a member of that 2000 Gold Cup winning side for Canada and other things involving Canadian soccer as well. Now, here we go quickly. Mr. Nathan Carr from the home of CaribbeanFootball.wordpress.com on the CONCACAF World Cup qualifying draw for 2018, as well as the Under-20 recap.
And once again, 40 Scenes Fire American Soccer Show, as we get ready and talk about wonderful things in CONCACAF, once again, of course, from the home of CaribbeanFootball.wordpress.com. It is Mr. Nathan Carr. Thank you, Nathan, for coming back.
No, thank you. Thanks, everyone.
No problem. No problem at all. So here we go. We're going to go with the World Cup qualifying draw first, rounds 1 and 2. Very interesting draw, what we have here in the first round. I have to say, I didn't understand why it was so much laughter in the W Hotel when the Bahamas was drawn against Bermuda. I guess that's a big derby match.
Yeah, I wasn't too sure either. It's geographically, they're not that close together. because Bahamas is north and Bermuda's sort of, well, they are, yeah, maybe it is a geographical thing. I'm not too sure, because Bermuda isn't exactly right next to Bahamas. Bahamas against Turks and Caicos Islands might have been a little bit more of a rivalry, but yeah, there seemed to be quite a lot of laughter for a lot of the draws, actually. But no, that Bahamas against Bermuda, I think that's one of the standout matchups, actually, of the first round. That's going to be really close, and I know that Bermuda are already in training. They've assembled a training camp with a few local-based players, and then you've got, like, Naki Wells and Reggie Lamb, who play in England, who are going to join up. So that should be a really fun game to watch. And then a few other standouts as well from that first round for me. Turks and Caicos host St. Kitts and Nevis first, and then in the second leg, St. Kitts hosts that. That'll be an interesting one. I know St. Kitts and Nevis will be expected to win that. And then Curaçao, who are, for me, are the strongest team in the first round, Curaçao. They play Montserrat. And I've been talking to a few of the Montserrat players on social media, and they said that, you know, they're by no means going to underestimate Curaçao, and that should be a good game.
It really will be. I know you've been really concentrating on Suriname, and even though they've been drawn the second round, they're going to face the winners of Nicaragua or Angola. I would like to think maybe Nicaragua has a little bit of an advantage here, just being a Central American side, but not much is known about Angola, honestly, and that could be either a strong matchup against Suriname in the second round, or maybe Angola could surprise people.
I'm not sure Angola. Yeah, I watched Angola at the 2014 Caribbean Cup last year, and they're a country that is lacking seriously. I mean, they're not very well developed in terms of, you know, facilities or you know, talent in that country. And I think they let in something like 20 goals, and they might have scored one. So I expect Nicaragua to beat Anguilla quite convincingly in the first round. And then, yeah, as you say, it's a tough start for Suriname. I can think of a few other islands that that would have given them maybe an easier game. But it very much depends with Suriname. We should hear soon, by the way, about, if you listened to last week's show about the bill that's been submitted, we should hear soon if that's been successful or not. But I don't know too much about Nicaragua, actually. Obviously they're Central American, so that usually means that they've got some sort of upper hand over the Caribbean teams, but that should be interesting to watch that one. There's lots and lots of interesting matchups. Another one in the second round is St. Vincent and the Grenadines against Guyana, because I know that Guyana have just appointed a new manager for a friendly against Barbados in early February, and it'll be interesting to see, will they keep with Jamal Shabazz, who's the new manager there in Guyana, for the World Cup qualifiers, because he so impressively led them, Guyana, to the third round in the 2014 qualifying cycle. So that's one to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, in the second round as well, Antigua and Barbuda taking on St. Lucia. To me, that sounds like an interesting matchup, depending on, I guess, who's stronger than the other, but still, I think Antigua and Barbuda is going to probably be a tough, tough side.
Yeah, Antigua and Barbuda are a team that are developing nicely. They didn't do as well as they would have liked in the 2014 Caribbean Cup, but they've really tapped into the British diaspora, and they've plucked a few guys who play in the English lower leagues. And you've got players like Jorin John of Nuneaton, players like Jordan Smith of Stamford, a guy from Blackburn, Aaron Tumwa. So Antigua have got a strong team. But then again, I know I said last time I was on the show, you know, St. Lucia, a team that, you know, you really can't underestimate. So they're two very even teams, Antigua and St. Lucia. And then you've got Puerto Rico against Grenada. Grenada are another team that are trying to tap into the British diaspora. I know that Chinny Joseph, the president there at the Grenada Football Association, is working very hard to try and track down some guys who are eligible for Grenada, who can help them. So yeah, you know, Canada as well. Canada were in a pot by themselves, weren't they? But they've been drawn against British Virgin Islands or Dominica. So I can see them. That's quite a favourable draw, I think. I can see them progressing to round three.
Yeah, absolutely. And Puerto Rico, obviously, you're going to have probably a lot of dual citizenships. Coming from the New York City area, and a lot of Puerto Ricans in New York City.
that'll probably play for the national team down in Puerto Rico against Grenada, and that should be pretty interesting there as well. So that will be I think it's a pretty good matchups here for rounds 1 and 2. We'll find out what happens when July 25th comes around for the full FIFA World Cup draw after all the preliminary earlier rounds are finished.
Can I just say as well, just to quickly add, Barbados,
mm-hmm.
I think they've been given quite a good draw because they should beat comfortably US Virgin Islands. And then if they do, they've got Aruba in round 2. And I think that Barbados have got more quality than Aruba. And I think that they are two very, very favourable draws for Barbados, who are another team that are making strides. And have got a technical director, Mark Filopo, who's a Brazilian, who's been... doing some good work over there on the island.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool to hear. All right, let's go to the under 20 tournament right now. You have to say, right now, with this tournament, I thought Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago were going to do a little bit better in Group A, even though they're in the U.S.'s group still. The way that I thought that both sides came out like gangbusters, I thought that they were going to actually do something, and then they just fell apart.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know if we had too high expectations for Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago. I mean, Jamaica were always going to have a little bit more pressure on them because they are the hosts.
Mm-hmm.
And they both, to be honest, both countries have got some really, really talented players. I think Group A has been a lot tighter than Group B. I mean, Panama have absolutely dominated Group A. They've been a really good, solid team. And they haven't dropped a point yet. They've won every single game. And then, hosts Jamaica after losing to USA yesterday.
Yes.
They're now officially eliminated along with Aruba. And Trinidad and Tobago stand a tiny, tiny chance of qualifying for the playoffs because they've got USA on Wednesday night, Trinidad and Tobago have. And I think they've got to beat them something by, 8 goals or something ridiculous. It was going to have to take a miracle. So more or less, Jamaica and Aruba are definitely eliminated, and more or less Trinidad and Tobago. It's been a shame. I mean, Jamaica, Trinidad and Tobago played in the opener, and it looked as if TNT were going to absolutely, cruise to victory, going 2 goals up. But credit to Jamaica for fighting back. But both from then, from there on in, didn't really push on as much as they would have liked to have done. With Jamaica, fans have blamed two things. Firstly, they pointed the finger at the coach, Theodore Whitmore, who was in charge of the national men's team for the 2014 qualifying for Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
He got them to the hex, but they didn't score enough goals, and they finished. They didn't manage to get through to Brazil. Apparently, his tactics have come under question. And secondly, They believe that there should be an overhaul of the youth development policy there in Jamaica. Winfrey Scaffa, who's the Jamaican senior boss, he's come out and said that he doesn't think the current crop of under-20s with Jamaica are good enough to play for the national team. Because I think Scaffa's been there in attendance at a few games, or he's watched them somehow. And I probably agree. I mean, you've got players like Michael Seaton and Cardell Bembo who have been making a breakthrough into the seniors of late, but a lot of the other players, just aren't quite there. They're talented, but they haven't quite reached the stage where they'd be considered for the seniors. So, disappointing. And it looks as if now the best hope for a Caribbean team to get into the World Cup in New Zealand later this year is going to be with Haiti. Because, them in Group A, the three are all more or less eliminated. And then in Group B, you've got Cuba and Haiti. Haiti are probably the ones that we're all banking on to do the Caribbean proud.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought Cuba was going to pull a major upset against Mexico. Ha! Foolish I am. Foolish I am.
9 goals later.
Exactly. I mean, it was a great goal to get off and running, to go 1-0 up, and then all of a sudden it's 9-1 down.
The issue with Cuba is they just cannot defend. They cannot defend. I mean, you're right. When Eddie Sanam, the guy that scored that wonder goal, I thought, right, they're in with a chance now. We all make mistakes. Mexico have started well. maybe they'll be able to get back into it. But they had absolutely no defensive discipline or shape. And I think that's a key thing, because, you know, the gulf between maybe the Central American and the Caribbean sides isn't necessarily the talent. The skill and the talent is there. It's perhaps the structure, and it's, you know, knowing how to win. I mean, you know, a classic example is Guatemala against Trinidad and Tobago in Group A. Don't know if you caught any of that game, but Guatemala won 2-0, and it was an absolute travesty because Trinidad and Tobago absolutely all over and peppered the opponent's goal, you know, dominated. But Guatemala had two chances, Rufus scored, and they knew how to win the game. And, you know, I've said on Twitter, I'm just not sure if the Caribbean sides have that game-winning mentality and have that organisation to be able to, you know, to get to these major tournaments over the Central American teams, you know?
I think that's the one thing about...
And that is Mr. Nathan Carr. We'll play that interview a lot later on, maybe before the MLS preview shows get underway. But now it's time to talk to my next guest, and this gentleman here will be running Louisville City FC in the USL Pro League. They will be the affiliate for Orlando City in MLS. It is head coach, Mr. James O'Connor. Coach, welcome to the, shall I say manager, I apologize if I got the lingo wrong. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good evening. How are you doing?
Yes, welcome. So this must be exciting for you. I mean, you're going to be running a brand new club, a brand new side in the third division of American football here in the United States. Talk about that excitement that you're ready to, you're raring to go, I understand.
Yeah, no, obviously we're really excited. I mean, we've been in a position where we've been busy looking at players. We've been scouting all over the world, basically. So we've got some really exciting players that are going to come out and play for us next season. So there'll be an exciting announcement tomorrow, which we're looking forward to. So we can't wait to get started. I mean, pre-season for us will start on February 16th. So we're eagerly awaiting that day to arrive.
Now, talk about the city of Louisville. Obviously, it's in the state of Kentucky. You're not far away from Cincinnati, Ohio. It's obviously not a long distance of a drive. Talk about how excited the city is to see this club getting ready to go, getting ready to play, and taking on some of these big-time clubs like Charleston Battery, Richmond Kickers, Wilmington Hammerheads, and Harrisburg City Islanders.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look around Louisville and speak to the people, they all can't wait. They're eagerly awaiting the schedule, which should be announced hopefully within the next 7 to 10 days. So I think that'll be something that, again, has been eagerly awaited by a lot of people in Louisville, and there'll be a few surprises in there as well. I think the people of Louisville will be really pleased with some of the teams we'll play, because we're obviously aware of some of the teams that have come into the league. There's obviously MLS teams that will be playing some of their games, the second teams in the league as well. So I think there'll be some MLS teams that will be coming to Louisville to play as well. So I think once the schedule comes out again, I think people will be really pleased, and I'm sure we're going to see another spike in season tickets. I mean, the season tickets have been flying out the door. So it's been incredible, the response we've had locally from people, and I think everyone at this stage just wants the schedule and wants to see our jersey and wants to see the players. So, you know, it's something we're all really excited about.
Now, being this, I'm assuming this will be your first head coaching position, or your first real manager position with any professional club that you've been a part of. What style will you be bringing to Louisville City? What type of formations? And do you straight out attacking? You like to see some midfield play to lead up to a opportunity. What type of team will we see Louisville City become when the season gets underway?
Well, we'll be a very entertaining team. I definitely like to attack. I like to be entertained, so I don't want to be stood on the side of the pitch sort of scratching my head wondering what's happened. I want to see fast, free-flowing, attacking football, and that's something we're definitely going to bring. You know, our style is possession-based, and we'll definitely have some good pace in the team. So, you know, we've got some really exciting players that I'm sure the supporters are going to be, well, really look forward to seeing and watching, and some of the younger players locally will be able to come out and watch and see them play. So I think for us it's just a case of getting the season, get pre-season started and get the season underway, and we can't wait to put on a great show and entertain everybody.
Now, you were obviously in Philadelphia with Orlando City, watching them draft some players for their club. Hopefully you'll be getting them as well to start off the 2015 season. Are you happy with the picks that Orlando City has done so far to get this side ready?
Yeah, obviously Orlando have a huge job on their hands. I mean, they're also in their first season in a brand new league. So for them, it's been incredible. An incredible journey, really. I mean, they've been able to set themselves up in USL and then finally make that jump into the MLS. And if you look at the caliber of player that they have actually signed, I mean, you've got Kaká, you've got some huge names that from South America, and also they're in talks with people from the UK as well. If you look at some of their signings, I think it's been an incredible journey, and there's a real excitement there. So when you add into the mix then the draft and the players that they have selected, you know, it bodes very well for them, and also what bodes well for them will bode well for us, because obviously we're their affiliation, and we will have players from their squad that will come and join us. So we're really excited by the affiliation, and we're very excited by the opportunity to have some of their players come and play for us next season.
Now, obviously, Adrian Heath will be the head coach for Orlando City, like he has been the last several years when they were in the USL Pro League. Do you talk to Adrian about what goes on or what will go on when you're going to have training sessions before matches get underway in the USL Pro League? How close is the communication between you and Adrian Heath?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I was in Orlando myself as a player and then a player coach for 2.5 years. So obviously we've got a great relationship with Orlando. We're sort of very well aligned on our football philosophy. That was one of the things that attracted me to Orlando was, you know, I was at a stage with my playing career in England where I could have stayed in England and played longer, but we had come out on holiday and watched Orlando train and watched him play. And there was definitely an alignment on how I believe and how he believes the game should be played. So we have very similar philosophies, and you know, we both like to play attacking football, possession based, and create overload. So I think, you know, for us it was a great opportunity to have an affiliation with Orlando, and it's something again that I say we're really excited about because we have such a close relationship.
Absolutely, and it looks like it's going to go off pretty well. I understand right now there's some construction update photos of the new training facility for Louisville City. Where will they be training at, and how excited will you be when everything is finally finished with the construction?
Yeah, I mean, obviously for us it's been, you know, incredible for the 6 months. We've got a lot going on. The training ground should be completed sort of very soon, which again will be another project for us. It's just off River Road, so it's something that we feel will be a great environment for the players to be able to go and help them develop their game. The locker room obviously is in the process of being finalised and finished off probably in the next, I would say, 3 to 4 weeks. So again, the locker room, the training ground, we have a lot going on, but it's all really exciting. You know, as we get nearer to pre-season and the start of season, I think just the excitement will build. And you know, I know we've announced some players, but we've a few more players that we can start to announce once their registration information starts to come through. So we've got some really exciting players that we're going to be able to announce in the next coming weeks, also aligned with the schedule. So there's some big announcements coming from Louisville City in the next few weeks.
Talk about the two players you've already signed. You have Sean Reynolds, formerly, of course, a long time ago, looks like a member of the old VSI Tampa Bay side, and from FC Edmonton in the NESL, you brought over Adam West. Talk about what both players will do with how you will be giving them instructions on what you want done with the ball.
Yeah, I mean, Adam is an attacking outside back, you called him here, left back. He's someone who has got a very good left foot. He's a very good passer. He's got good spring, so he's very capable in the air. He came to our tryout back in November, and he excelled. I mean, he's he's someone who has won some championships at different levels in the US. He provides great experience for us. And Sean obviously was at VSI. He started at Orlando under 23s. And then he also had a stint in the Icelandic Premier Division and has some Europa League experience. So two players, very experienced and high-caliber players who we feel will perform very well for us next season. So we have both of them. We have Guy, who is an Israeli holding midfielder who had been... we managed to sign him ahead of an Israeli Premier League team. Again, it was a fantastic signing for us. He's got great discipline and very, very strong presence in midfield. And we have Juan Guzman, a holding midfielder from Charlotte, who again has great USL experience and is a very good footballer. So we're really excited by the players that we have and by the players that we will be announcing soon. We actually have an announcement, I believe, tomorrow again, which should really excite people, and I'm sure they'll be really impressed with the caliber of player that we're starting to sign.
Absolutely, and you will be playing most of your matches at the baseball stadium at the home of the Louisville Bats. It should be interesting to see how that setup is, but obviously it doesn't matter. You'll be playing at a fantastic location at the moment. Talk about that, being a part of the whole Louisville sports scene, especially in that stadium.
Yeah, I mean, I think the location of the stadium is second to none. It's in the middle of downtown. I think everyone locally is aware of the stadium, so I think people will be able to go out on a Saturday night, have a few drinks, come out, watch the soccer game, and then walk back into downtown and have a few more beers. So I think the location is excellent for us. It gives us a great opportunity to get some really good crowds. I know the city is very supportive of what we're doing, so we're very hopeful that we're going to get really good crowds and we're going to be able to entertain people and be very successful. As I say, some of the players that we've signed, I mean, Kadeem, who I didn't mention, Kadeem Dakers, is a very fast attacking player. He's someone who will definitely excite some of the fans as well. So the players that we have signed and will start to announce, I think people are going to be really impressed and surprised by some of the signings we've been able to capture. So there's some really exciting news to come out within the next sort of 3 to 4 weeks that, again, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be really, really impressed with the caliber of our signings.
Absolutely. Have any of the baseball players came up to you or gave you a phone call, the manager of the baseball side, that they said good luck with 2015?
No, I mean, we haven't sort of seen them yet. I mean, we will obviously be based there once our locker room is completed. At the moment, our offices are in downtown, so a lot of our time has been spent there and obviously out looking at players. So I'm sure once we're based there, we'll start to see more of the Bats. And, you know, they've obviously been very helpful with allowing us use the stadium, and we wish them the very best of luck for next season as well.
Now, I'm here right now to dig on some dirt on a former manager of yours that's currently running the Houston Dynamo, and that is Owen Coyle. So if you have anything to say about Owen right now, the microphone is open. You can do whatever you want, and you can shed some light on the type of man he is or what he did for you back in England when you were playing as a football player.
Yeah, no, obviously I played for Owen. You know, he's someone who I have tremendous respect for. It was great to catch up with him in Philadelphia and obviously Fort Lauderdale down at the Combine. So, you know, for him to come and get an opportunity in Houston, I know he's really excited by that, and he can't wait to get started over there. He's someone who definitely motivates people. He's an excellent motivator, and he's a great positive approach to football or soccer, as it's called here. So I'm sure he'll do very well there. And, you know, again, he's someone who I hold in very high regard.
Is he a good singer?
I'm not quite sure how good his singing is. He's a good coach. He knows his football. So I'm sure the people in Houston will be pleased to hear that, you know.
Absolutely. I really, I mean, I'm just trying to joke around, obviously. I'm not trying to get you in trouble. No, no, no.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
no,
maybe
a little bit. I have a great relationship with him. He's a great sense of humor, you know. I mean, we get on great. So, no, he's someone who will do well. I mean, he's very passionate and very driven. So again, I know he's excited by the challenge he has there in Houston as well. So it'll be interesting to keep an eye on how they do as well.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Mr. O'Connor, thank you so much for the time. I really do appreciate it. Good luck to you and Louisville City for the first year in USL Pro. I hope that you do well. You can get to the playoffs if it is in the cards. Thank you again, and good luck this year.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And that's James O'Connor, the new head coach of Louisville City, that will be the affiliate of Orlando City in MLS. And, of course, for the USL Pro League, we'll see what happens. And now it's time to bring over a good friend of mine that I've known for a good long time since college, a very, very, very great soccer player in his time at Ramapo College, Division III in the NJAC. Yes, I know, Rob. I'm laying it thick. Don't worry. my good friend Rob Hack, season ticket holder of the New York Rebels, who was at the Red Bull Town Hall. Rob, how are you? And let me just say this, Mazel Tov, very soon you'll have a new addition to your family.
Thank you, sir. We're very excited and nervous as first parents can be.
Yeah, I know. You know, you're a brand new dad and everything. So, well, not yet. The baby's not born yet, but still.
No, not yet.
Not yet. But I'm happy for you and your wife. Congratulations and everything.
Thank you, sir.
No problem. Let's unfortunately get down to business because obviously it hasn't been a great week for New York MLS soccer. Obviously,
what are you talking
about? You all know
what
happened with the Frank. I think you do. But you were at the town hall meeting at Red Bull Arena. You saw Ali Curtis, sporting director. You saw Jesse Marsh, the new head coach, Mark de Grand Prix, the GM, as well as in a lot of front office stuff. And, of course, Luis Robles was there as well. Obviously, a lot of heated words, a lot of interesting dialogue. You go ahead and you tell everyone what you saw and how you perceived it to be.
Sure. You know, as you mentioned, there was obviously a good contingent of people that would rather have Red Bull get the heck out of town. What I will say is the amount of vitriol they received, I don't think is necessarily indicative of the community at large. I still think most of our fan base and ticket holder base is pretty apathetic to the whims of the front office. With that said, I think it was very indicative of the most diehard and actual supporters to the feeling that is going on. You know, Pecky was one of us. Pecky is loved. He wasn't in any way, shape, or form perfect. I think there's been a bit of a rose-colored glasses when looking at Pecky from everybody's standpoint. But with that said, the night certainly didn't help the front office in the overall. The number of people that were yelling at them weren't as many as I had expected, but what was getting yelled for probably the first 10 to 15 minutes was worse than I had feared. Namely, people were asking questions and then screaming immediately that, you know, they weren't answering the questions. It was a fair observation, but, you know, when you're sitting in front of a room of 300 people that aren't necessarily on your side, I can understand it taking a few minutes to warm up. With that said, I'll say that Jesse Marsh did exactly that. I think he only kind of helped his situation. He was very personable, I guess is the right way to say it. He was answering questions directly. He made it very clear that, yeah, I could very well be fired in a year, you know, directly answering somebody that said, you're going to be gone in a year. And he said, yeah, that's entirely possible. I just hope that, you know, that I can bring the team to help win and improve the team and hopefully earn your dedication. And he was, you could tell he took some things very personally. There were some shouts about him being terrible at Montreal, and he was rightly defensive on that. You know, his time at Montreal was the third best expansion record in history. You know, it was beaten by Chicago, who pulled the double, and it was beaten by Seattle, who had a slightly better record, but also won the Open Cup their inaugural year. Short of that, you know, as far as the expansions have gone, he did well. Robles is absolutely a unicorn. He's just a great guy. If anybody's had the fortune of meeting him personally, you know, one-on-one, he's a great guy. And up there, he was you know, answering everybody's questions to the best of his ability. The only time I saw him get defensive was when someone implied that the front office was wrong in bringing Robles up there and forcing him to come up and, you know, making him do this as part of his job. Robles was very quick to point out that he had volunteered to come in. He had volunteered to basically go in front of the angry masses and, you know, try and deal with things. With that said, I don't think it was necessarily the best move by the front office bringing a player in that's well-liked. I mean, it wouldn't have helped them if they brought in a player nobody liked. But it smacked a little bit of trying to find a cover. As the time went on and people were continuing to yell, Marc de Grand Prix got quieter and quieter, mostly because the anger seemed to be directed at Mr. Curtis, rightly so or wrongly so. The thing that everybody seemed to agree on was way too much marketing babble, way too much unintentionally trying to sell things. And I don't know if it was a matter of him having worked at the HQ as long as he did, but he certainly didn't help his situation. for a man who hopefully had hit rock bottom and had nowhere to go but up, it seemed like somebody kept handing him shovels. So not a terrible night for the front office in the sense that hopefully there was some improvement with how the fans will see Jesse Marsh, but I think that Curtis and the Grand Prix could have been better served by standing outside and giving away candy because they certainly weren't helping their situation inside.
Let me ask you this, because I will agree with you. I think Jesse Marsh did help his own cause. I believe, like you've said, that Jesse did find a way to ease up with everyone that was yelling at him and everything, and I agree with you on that. But with Ali Curtis, did you feel he was trying to give long-winded answers to simple questions? Because to me it sounded like, now I could be wrong, but at the moment it just sounds like he just was basically painted into a corner all night and he just couldn't defend himself.
So I'm going to give two answers to that because there's nothing like me being long-winded. It's just like college. The first thing I'll say is I'm not firmly in any camp. My comment that night to a variety of people is I'm firmly burned out. I'm disappointed in this front office, and I have absolutely no confidence in their ability to avoid shooting themselves in the leg. But I'm also disappointed in our fan base, in how they've handled certain things, the demeanor by which they've gone through things. And that specifically relates to treatment of front office personnel that are tangentially related to the issue at hand, to the individuals that showed up at Red Bull Arena and screamed at an intern who happened to be showing up at his first day of work, things like that. That said, you know, playing devil's advocate, I think Curtis got better as the night went on. I think he probably started the day at a 0 or a 1 on a scale of 1 to 10. I think by the end of the town hall, he was probably a 3 or a 4 as far as answering questions and how he was answering them. Having been in front of large audiences like that, I can say that I think he probably was nervous. He was probably a little uncomfortable up there at the bare minimum, but I think he was relying on what he knew best, which was marketing jargon and was bullshit, you know, is the smoke and mirrors. And I think as he got more comfortable up there trying to answer what people were asking him, he relied on that a little bit less. I don't think it was nearly as much as he needed to, but I will play devil's advocate on that and give him the benefit of the doubt of he was nervous and that wasn't going to help him. With that said, the answers he was giving were not direct answers. I also think that some of the questions, you have to expect they're not going to be direct answers. No employer is going to come up in public and If there were issues within the front office and dealing with Mike Pecky, they're not going to come out right and say, well, we fired him because he was boozing and, you know, there was this issue and that issue. They're not going to do that because it opens them up to lawsuits and it makes them look worse. So I think anybody that went in there expecting to be able to demand a forthright answer on the actual reason Pecky was fired was fooling themselves. I do think that he didn't help his situation by giving long meandering answers. I think if he had simply said, the decision was mine, I came in, I decided we needed a staffing change, and I made that decision, end of story. And if he had stuck with that, fine. I think he tried to pretty it up and paint it another color, and he got rightfully hung out for it. I think the best thing that happened all night was Mark doing his best to keep his mouth shut and stay out of the way and, quite frankly, let it all hit Curtis.
I agree with you on that because I think we know Mark the Grand Prix only didn't really last that long, with maybe 2 years as the sporting director back then for this club. Obviously, we all know about the whole Bruce Arena thing, and he's just a marketing person right now, and that's all he really should be concerned about is the marketing department of this club. Let me ask you personally, we've known each other for a good long time. I know how dedicated you are to whatever cause that you are a part of. I know that you are a loyal guy to certain people, obviously, and certain things. Does this change how you want to support this club? Do you feel you've had enough and you're going to move on? Or are you just going to, I'm not trying to put you into a deep hole are you going to go ahead?
No, that's a perfectly fair question. The way I put it is the Cosmos was never my team. Short of a particular individual we both knew from school who did everything he could to pimp out that brand and make money for himself, that's the only interaction I ever had with the Cosmos. I'm not going to NYCFC LMNOP because, quite frankly, I don't see them being any better, and they're not my team. I've found a family here. My wife has enjoyed it. Our first date was a game with the Red Bulls. I'm not going anywhere. Yep. I'm not going anywhere. What has happened is, for sure, my wife and I are going to make an effort that, you know what, we really don't need to buy soda and beer in the stadium. We don't need to buy food in the stadium. We don't need to buy jerseys. We don't need to buy – you want to give us free stuff? We'll take it, and we'll wear it. But the – not confidence, but the willingness to go out and spend extra money on an organization that clearly can't get out of its own way is not something I'm willing to do. I don't blame them for firing Pecky. I don't know whether it was a good decision or a bad decision. I'll give Jesse Marsh the benefit of the doubt, and I want to see how he does. I do have confidence that he's going to do well enough. What bothers me is how the situation was handled, that they were not prepared for a leak, that they had to expect that any organization I've ever been a part of, if you're dealing with a large public announcement, you have plan A, which is, hey, if everything goes well and we're going to go out with this, great, this is how we handle it. And plan B is, if somebody opens their mouth, this is how we deal with it. And it seemed like they didn't have a plan B, which worries me. So the long story short is, I'm not going anywhere, but my wallet is.
That's fair. That is really a lot more fair than what I've been hearing from some people. Look, I'm not going to tell people what they should or shouldn't do. That's not my call. You know, look, but the point is, though, is that, you know, however they want to support this club, it's up to them. If they feel like they've had enough, fine. Go and support the other team and just, you know, don't get on the soapbox and do it. Just say, I'm done, goodbye, and then just move on. That's how I feel. It doesn't matter what team it is, that whoever supports what. You're done with it? Okay. Don't get on the soapbox. Just walk across the river or drive across the river, however you can get there.
But I think there's a very fine point there, that, and I agree with you, there is a fair number of people. There's people that I have forcefully and happily turned my back on through social media and communications I would have had with them otherwise, because of the grandstanding and the whining and the look at me, I'm storming away from this. But yet they continue to use the word, we're going to do this and we're going to have that. Those are the people that I have no problem slamming the door in front of. The people I won't and the people I'll support, Red Bull Out has done a great thing getting the information out there and trying to get people involved. I don't necessarily agree with a lot of what is said because, as I said, I've reached the I just don't care. I don't have enough energy to spend time on that.
Mm-hmm.
But these are people that care. They want a team that they can be proud of. They want a front office that gets it. And they've made the determination personally that Red Bull isn't it. It's way too corporate even for this MLS franchise structure. And they want something different. And they're doing what they can with the resources that they have available to them and availing themselves of their opportunities to try and push for that. To me, those people are a completely different set than the people that have stormed off and just thrown up their hands and said, screw you guys, I'm going home. These are people that have said, no, we're not going to stand in with Red Bull. No, we're not going to support them, but we want our team. We want a team here for us, that if that happened, they'd come back. Those are the people that if Red Bull sold tomorrow, I would happily stand with in the stands, and I would happily support them, and I support them through what they're doing. But the former people are the people that, no, I'm not going to hang out in a bar with you and drink. No, I will not go to road games with you. I will not stand with you. You're not someone I believe in. You're not somebody I trust. You don't have the heart for this. So I think there's a very big difference there.
And I absolutely agree with you. I agree with you 100%. So let me ask you this question right now. Let's just say, hypothetically, this Mr. Adder person who helped out with that electronic billboard sign along 280 in Harrison near Red Bull Arena. Let's just say for the heck of it, he does purchase the club, maybe makes a deal, tells Red Bull you can still pay for the naming rights, the jersey sponsorship rights. But let's just say for the heck of it, we bring back the red and black and we bring back the name Metro Stars. Would you be opposed to that? Or would you like to look at something else?
The easiest way I can say is I just want to see quality games. I want to see quality players. I love being within 20 feet, 30 feet of the field. My fear of saying I don't care who owns the team is that the next owner is worse than the present owner. You know, that Pepsi Cola decides to buy the company, decides to buy the team, or White Castle, you know. That's my biggest fear. I think Adder has gotten involved. I think he's been a savvy businessman. He saw an opportunity for free PR, and he took it. I don't know anything about the guy. I don't know anything about what his plans are in actuality. I only know what he's said and what's kind of floated through the echo chamber. Would I love to see Metro Colors back? Yes, because it's our history. But in the same vein as I wasn't connected to Red Bull, to me, Metro is more the legacy than it is a brand I necessarily need to go back to. I'd be just as happy. I'd be happier singing for Metro and wearing Metro clothing than I've ever been doing Red Bull. But it's more of an honor to, or a show of respect to the people that have come before me that have built the support for this team over 20 years before the 6 years I came in. So it's kind of six of one, half dozen of the other as far as a different ownership group coming in and what they do. I would look at it that, for me, I treat it the same way I treat Jesse Marsh. You've got a little bit of rope. You've got a year. You've got some time. I want to see what you're going to do. You may not be perfect, but show me that you get it. Show me that you get the fans. Show me that you get what we want. And you'll earn that credibility. And unfortunately, if I live in a slum, if I live in a rundown house and I want my house to be better, it's great when a new landlord comes along and buys the place. But unless he fixes it, he's no better than the last guy. And the one thing that people seem to forget is, as much as we hearken back and we want to have Metro and we want to get rid of this walking advertisement that is Red Bull, the old boss is, or the new boss is just as bad as the old boss as far as on-field performance and as far as the FO not getting it. I would just like to see that change. I don't, quite frankly, I don't have the confidence that Red Bull is going to sell, but that's what I would want to see change.
Well, Rob, listen, thank you very much for the time, and thank you for giving me your opinion, because I know that I could have brought over anybody, but you know what? I really want to hear from you because I know that you believe in something very passionately, just like I do, and I know for a fact that you definitely had a lot of common sense to be brought about this subject. And believe me, just like you and I, we both believe in something. We're both passionate about something. And if it's not just this club, it's the sport in the United States. So listen, Rob, thanks a lot for the time. Again, congratulations on the new edition, soon to be coming in a couple of months, I believe.
Yep,
and,
March.
I hope
we're excited this year, this time next year. Hopefully they'll be seeing games at whatever arena they call it.
Absolutely. But listen, Rob, thanks a lot for the time. I really do appreciate it, and I'll definitely talk to you. I'll definitely call you when the show's over, so I'll talk to you later, okay?
All right, thanks a lot, Dan. Bye-bye.
No problem. Thank you. That's Robert Hawk, former board member of the Empire Supporters Club that was at the town hall meeting with the New York Red Bulls about the situation. And, you know, got to say, this has caused a lot of problems. A lot of problems with the way that Mike Petke's dismissal was handled, the way the front office has looked. Of course, Jesse Marsh is not to be blamed for this. Jesse Marsh is definitely not to be blamed for this. And we don't know what Ali Curse is going to be doing. There's been some rumors about a possible trade, sending Ambrose Oyongo to Montreal for Philippe Martinez and possibly also the number one spot in the allocation order, maybe to bring over Sasha Kleiston. So far, Leo Stoltz has been signed to a contract from the draft. He wanted to be either with the Galaxy or the Red Bulls, and he's with the Red Bulls. He was picked up by him, and apparently he signed a deal. So we got to say right now that at this moment, it's some pretty good business. Some pretty good business happened here with the Red Bulls. Still, a lot of people very, very upset at what the situation is. And all I can say to Red Bull fans is this. We need to have the understanding that this situation is still going to be tricky. This situation is still going to be very, very tricky in the next couple of weeks because we don't know what Ali Curse is really doing. It's been a lot of GM speak, if you want to say it in that sense. I don't know, to be honest, what will lie ahead for Mr. Curtis. I only hope that whatever his plan is, and let me just say this, I'm glad he's understanding that youth development and to bring these players into the first team like he has for Sean Davis. A shame that Dan Metzger did not want to be here. He would rather go into the draft instead of signing a homegrown contract with the Red Bulls. Of course, with certain players from the past, look, there's nothing you can do about it. The past is the past. And now we got to just move forward with the present as well as the future. But we'll see what this club will be made of. Like I said before, a lot of questions that need to be answered. Unfortunately, it's a situation where we're probably not going to get any answers until the regular season gets underway at Sporting Kansas City, Sunday, March 8th, on Fox Sports 1 at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Central. And, of course, we're going to have to wait and see what what's going to happen with the CBA. A lot of people saying that there will not, doesn't look like there will be a work stoppage, and it looks like there won't be a lockout. and there won't be a strike. So we'll see what happens, obviously, as we get ready. Hopefully that there will be a season. But one thing is for sure. This is a mess that definitely could have been avoided if, I'm not going to say if the story wasn't leaked. What we will say is if he probably should have kept Mike Pecky and just see what would have happened, and you hired Jesse Marsh at the time as the assistant coach. So all I can say is this. There's a lot of questions that need to be answered. And the only way they're going to get answered is when the season gets underway. Because right now, there are too many questions, and there's not enough answers, and they're not being answered. So at the moment, talk is cheap, and action needs to be done when we get to the field. And once again, we're going to have to see March 8th, because that's the only way right now that we're going to see with this side. A lot of talks about Tim Cahill possibly not wanting to come back to finish up his contract and staying in Australia after the Asian Cup. We'll see what happens. But the truth of the matter is this. We're going to have to wait and see what the situation will be once the Asian Cup is over for Australia. And we're going to have to wait and see what Jesse Marsh is going to do with the roster that he is getting at the moment. So that's all I can say. And as we move on here, as we got some time remaining on the show, Forcing Fire American Soccer Show, get some time to let you know. Join me next Tuesday at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific, talking some more information of American soccer. And don't forget next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock Eastern, 4 o'clock Pacific, USA versus Chile in Chile, post-game show, first international friendly for the United States as Jurgen Klinsmann gets ready for the U.S. soccer calendar year. Of course, there's a Gold Cup to be played, and at the same time, at the end of the calendar year in November, we're going to start early World Cup qualifying. In the semifinal round, of course, let's not forget July 25th will be FIFA's World Cup qualifying confederational draw. All five confederations, of course, five out of six, not counting South America, as we already know, will be 10 teams in a round-robin style tournament in a league state stage, I should say, for all those teams. And at the same time, we'll see what's going to happen with Asia. We're going to see what's going to happen with UEFA, with Africa, Oceania, and then we'll see the rest of the draw for CONCACAF as the third round will be drawn. Teams that will be drawn into the semifinal round, which will be round four. And then, of course, we get to October, November of 2016, we'll see what's going to happen when we get to the final round, of course, the hexagonal, and it should be a lot of fun. But once again, everybody, this has been the Four Seasons Fire American Soccer Show here on blogtalkradio.com, and we will talk to you again next week as we get ready for some more soccer action. We'll get some more interesting stories for you and some more interesting things to discuss as we move forward here in the 2015 season. I want to thank my guests. I want to thank Craig Forrest from Sportsnet up in Canada. I want to thank Nathan Carr from the home of CaribbeanFootball.wordpress.com. I also want to thank James O'Connor, the head coach of Louisville City FC, and, of course, my good friend Robert Hawk, who is, of course, a member of the ESC and is a season ticket holder for the New York Red Bulls, on what happened over at the Red Bull Town Hall meeting. My name is Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you so much for listening tonight. And as I say goodbye to you as we get ready for next Tuesday and next Wednesday As always, please enjoy your football. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody. Talk to you next week. And thank you for being a loyal listener of the 4 Scenes Fire American Soccer Show. Good night. Bye-bye for now.